My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Speaking to our next guest reinforces the impact conflict has had on all of our society. She's a leading plastic surgeon who has performed countless reconstructive operations on members of the armed forces. We talk about the complications of trauma injuries, working with a military cohort, and how war has advanced medical science. Episode 24, Alex Crick. This is Declassified. Alex, where did you grow up?
So I was born in London. From the age of 7, I grew up in Poole in Dorset. And that's my dad's still living there now, so that's where my family are based. Mm. I've got a brother and sister who are nearby still.
Do you feel more of a Londoner? More of a Pooler?
More of a Pooler, yeah. More seasidey.
Yeah. And, I mean, we're fast-forwarding a bit now, but did you always want to be a plastic surgeon?
No, I had no idea what plastic surgery is, was. A bit like most other people, I think. Mm. It's a bit of a mystery.
Yeah.
I didn't know it existed then. So at school, I briefly thought I might want to be a mathematician, but made a last-minute swerve to medicine.
Mm.
And the nice thing about medicine is there's so much you can do within medicine. It's very likely that you'll find something that suits you. Mm. So I started off with a surgical rather than a medical bent. And then once I started surgery, and the sort of early training in surgery, realised that I like looking after trauma, particularly hand injuries. I love the anatomy of the hand.
How does it work then? Can you take us through like the process of, going to uni and then becoming a consultant? Is that the right word?
Yeah.
What's the kind of length of time? What do you have to go through to get to that point?
So I went straight from school after A-levels. A lot of people take a year out and then you go to university and that is your basic qualification as a doctor. And that will take you 5 or 6 years, 4 if you're already a graduate from another subject. And then once you leave medical school, you are a houseman for a year and then you become a junior doctor, which we used to call a senior house officer, and that will be for 3 or 4 years. And then you become a senior trainee, which we used to call a registrar, and that's 5 or 6 years in my specialty. And for plastic surgery, which is, and still is, a very competitive specialty, a lot of people will do a research degree in the middle of that as well, just to enhance their CV and to improve their chance of getting a specialist training.
Did you do that?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
What did you do?
I did an MD in developmental biology at the Department of Human Anatomy and Genetics in Oxford University.
Mm. And what's the early part of your career entail then? You know, when you go into, I suppose, the plastic surgery part of it, what are you actually doing? Are you just overseeing? Are you looking in on operations? When do you start getting your kind of hands on?
So the first bit of hands-on is as a houseman, you start doing things like putting IV lines in people, taking bloods, fairly basic things like that. And then as a senior house officer, you might be repairing facial lacerations in A&E, undertaking minor ops, so removing small lesions from people under local anaesthetic, assisting in theatre. So it's an apprenticeship. It used to be very much an apprenticeship surgery. So you'd assist your seniors and do parts of the operation under supervision. And then you'd graduate to doing simpler procedures with less supervision and then part elements of the more complex procedures. And then you graduate in that way.
Mm. And you briefly just overviewed it then, but why plastic surgery? Why was that so fascinating?
I looked into plastic surgery because of my interest in hand surgery to begin with, and you can become a hand surgeon either as an orthopaedic or a plastic surgeon, and the rest of plastic surgery was more appealing than orthopaedic surgery, so that's how I got into plastic surgery. But the beauty of plastic surgery is that it's a very generalized. It's a very general surgical specialty. You operate on all ages, all sorts of pathology, lots of trauma. You work with lots of other specialties. It's a very technique-based specialty, so it's interesting for that. There's a lot of problem-solving, planning surgery by along the lines of principles rather than protocol. So it's interesting from a technical point of view.
What's the difference between a protocol and a principle? What?
So, for example, in general surgery, there are lots of operations that are... There's a frequent selection of operations that are undertaken, and you learn how to do those in a stepwise fashion. But for example, with trauma especially, all the wounds are rather different, and you have to tailor what you're doing surgically to the characteristics of the wound. Yeah. So it's much more tailored.
So one's almost like standard operating procedures. You go from A to B to C.
Yeah.
Whereas it's more holistic. It's more let's see what we've got and let's
deal
with
it. Yeah, it's sort of tailored. It's designed for that specific problem.
And what is it? What is plastic surgery? Because I always think it's if someone said it to me before I met you, I understood a little bit more about what you do. I would think nose job. Tummy tuck.
Yeah. So why do I need to be on call? What's so urgent about a facelift? That sort of thing.
Yeah. What is it? What is plastic surgery?
So lots of people think plastic surgery is cosmetic surgery, and cosmesis or aesthetics is definitely part of what we do, an important consideration what we do. But mostly what we're doing is reconstructing a wound or a defect, and that might be something that you were born with, a congenital problem, or something that you've acquired either from trauma like being blown up or sepsis or a tumour that needs to be removed. And we're reconstructing that to get you healed and to restore your function as well as the aesthetics. And sometimes aesthetics is a really important part of the job. So, for example, a hand, the more normal a hand looks, the more likely you are to use it normally.
Psychologically?
Yes.
Because you're not hiding it or...
That's right. It's a very socially exposed part of you, a bit like your face.
Okay.
And it really matters how you look when you're interacting with other people. And therefore how you feel about yourself as well.
When did you start working with the military?
So my first... I work in Salisbury and we have a large military population nearby, so they get into all the usual scrapes. So I meet military patients in that way. But I think the more specifically and my special exposure to military patients has been through Headley Court.
How did that work? Especially back... What year was that when... You first started?
So that's 2008, so that was in the thick of the action. And a lot of people ask me this, because why me? Because I'm a civvy. Why? And I'm in Salisbury, what's that got to do with anything? But we met and knew somebody called Professor Rolf Birch, who's an orthopaedic consultant who established the peripheral nerve injury unit at St Mary's in London, and then at Stanmore. And he, when he should have been retired, started peripheral nerve injury clinics at Headley Court. And because a lot of limb injuries involve nerve problems. And he realised that it would be useful to have somebody with the sort of skills that a plastic surgeon has to fix some of those problems. And he invited us to join him in those clinics. Initially, my colleague Rod Dunn, and then I joined him. And it's... been the two of us involved since then.
And that was at Headley?
Yeah, so what we do is go to those clinics at least every month since April 2008. And if we saw anybody that we thought we could help with surgery, we'd bring them back to Salisbury for further assessment, and then all the surgery would take place in Salisbury.
And then, so my question has been quite linear at the moment, and then we'll get into it in a second, but 2008, what level of plastic surgeon are you now, you and Rod? Where are you at in kind of seniority?
So I was not long appointed as a consultant, So that's when you're working independently. So that's the sort of senior rank, if you like. Mm. And Rod was a few years ahead.
And so that, because it's that, even then, you know, like holistically, you know, you're going in and you're going, oh, we could do something there.
Yeah.
We could do something. And what typically are we dealing with then? Because of, obviously, with those that don't know, you know, often multiple trauma, really technical and quite complex trauma injury,
yeah,
especially from Afghan. What are you, again, typically faced with when you go do the clinics?
So the most frequent problem that we were presented with was injuries from dismounted IED detonation. So multiple injuries, often involving multiple significant amputation, and the aftermath of the initial treatment of that. And people would come with lots of a shopping list of problems, which would include pain, not being healed, nerves not working, joints, contracture of joints, ongoing infection, a mixture of those things.
Yeah, it's very complex.
Complicated because they're extreme injuries, they're multiple injuries, and they've had quite a lot of surgery already. And plastic surgery is very much a spare part type of specialty, and they're running out of spare parts as well.
So you're did you just call yourself a spare part?
Yeah. Or, yeah. A spare part surgeon, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because obviously the Camp Bastion and then Headley Court, you're dealing with trauma.
Yes.
Would you class that as dealing with trauma or a patient recovering from trauma? I don't know if there's any difference there. Are you dealing with that, not the initial...
So it's not the immediate management of trauma. It's late reconstruction following trauma, yeah. Mm. So this is happening at an interval. So they were injured. They were in Camp Bastion maybe for 24, 48 hours. Evacuated and then immediately managed in Selly Oak and then Queen Elizabeth in Birmingham. And they may be either transferred from there to Headley Court as an inpatient, or they might have gone home first and then come to Headley for rehabilitation. So Headley Court was the Defence Medical Rehabilitation Centre tri-service. So anybody that was injured and needed rehabilitation would go there.
And this was platinum standard, wasn't it? Headley Court.
It became so, yes. Mm. Yes.
Why did it develop into that kind of...
From that intense experience, from those numbers and the severity of those injuries, and from experience they acquired that expertise. Mm. And they may not have had it early on because we haven't had a conflict like this before. Mm. Certainly not with people in surviving these combination of injuries. Surviving these combination of injuries.
What do you mean?
These were unexpected survivors. So if these guys had presented to a hospital in the UK at the same time, they may not have survived.
So if someone was injured in exactly the same way outside a hospital in the UK,
yeah,
they may not have survived because they were in Afghanistan with the same injury.
Yeah,
and they did.
That's right, and it's for all sorts of reasons. And this is to the credit of the military in the way that they work this out pretty rapidly, how to minimise the fallout from these injuries. So immediate first aid, prompt evacuation to Camp Bastion, the way that Camp Bastion was organised, evacuation from Camp Bastion, Birmingham. So it's that whole sequence. That whole sequence meant that people were surviving, unexpectedly surviving these injuries. Mm. And then that presents us with more complex problems from a late reconstruction point of view.
Because this has never been seen before.
Correct, yeah.
You've never had this to... The medical science has never seen this injury in this way before.
No.
And I suppose let's talk about then the cohort kind of moved us a bit. I wanted to discuss this later on, but it seems relevant. So that military cohort,
mm-hmm.
we've got similar age, similar fitness levels,
yeah,
in the same place with the same medical team, the same yeah. training, sometimes the same bomb maker, the same material, everything. Professionally, what does that mean for you?
That is one of the reasons why they were... It's not just how they were being managed, it's also the fact that they were young and in the prime of their physical fitness and were tough individuals. That's, you know, that's one of the reasons why they were pulling through. And from my point of view, it means that I was dealing with the after effects of these extreme injuries, but in the otherwise ideal patient, which made it meant that I could do more surgically than I would have done in an older, less fit cohort of patients.
Because do you have to get permission from the patient to do certain things? Or
always, yeah. Yeah.
I don't mean that. I mean, like, you know, during it, you know, because you said that you've got, like, so we've just been for a non-alcoholic beverage before that. You had a coffee and I had a lime and soda. And you showed me some photos, and I could not believe a human being could do that. I genuinely believe, I mean what I say, that what you was explaining, how you was piecing things together, putting the heel of the foot in certain areas, moving body parts around, I just couldn't believe it. So does a patient then go, just do what you need to do? How does that work? You know,
that's consent's an interesting point, because we only ever do anything with the agreement of the patient or the request from the patient. But it's hard. We do our best to explain what we're going to do or what we'd suggest doing. But it's hard for you to understand, really understand what we're going to do. So it involves trust, unavoidably. And that requires a leap of faith. You know, if you've been through that sort of injury, you've survived it, you've been through whatever pretty harrowing experience to recover from that, and then you're deliberately submitting yourself to another injury and what it takes to get healed and recover again, all the downsides of that. You have to trust that the person that's going to do this to you knows what they're doing. So it is a leap of faith.
We've had permission from Simon Harmer, who was episode 5. You're smiling. to speak about him and his situation. He was totally cool with it. He said, you know, just whatever you want to speak about. And for him, when he said he was going through major surgery again and again, it's a real blow on his body. You go back months and months and months, so you progress. You've then got to have this major trauma again, this surgery again, that then puts your body right back.
Yeah.
And we talked about, like, in brackets, that cohort again. Yeah. These people, these mainly men. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. Resilience. Going backwards and then forwards and backwards and forwards sometimes. Is that having a toll on their mental health? How are they dealing with that? And I'm assuming then the trust with you, because you're dealing, I think you said you dealt with a third of Afghan trauma patients. Do you get to see them again and again?
I do, yeah. A lot of them are long-term projects.
Simon Harmer.
Including Si Harmer.
Long-term project.
Yeah, so when you first meet somebody, they've often got quite a long shopping list of problems, and you work out what's technically possible, what you might do in what order, what in combination. And you have to allow for what spare parts are available, mention that again. And then you need to allow for time in between that for healing, for recovery, and for a period of normality, especially if they've got family to look after as well. But it does take its toll. But if you start with something that works, turns out as hoped, and it's like a short snake for a longer ladder, then they know what, you know, it's an okay sacrifice.
To go through.
Yeah, just to get themselves further forward. Because what I think everybody wants is to be, to get to a point where they're as good as they can be physically. And then that they can put the surgery behind them, other than whatever they might need in the future for maintenance.
And I know there's no typical Afghan soldier. There was no one coming back with, because like we said, they're totally complex, never been seen before. But what was the what was you dealing with, especially at the start? What injuries? Like, go into detail. What was the injuries? Testicular, lower leg. What was you dealing with?
So a common combination of injuries are bilateral low limb injuries, particularly the right forearm. And there might be perineal injuries, abdominal injuries. So a combination of all those things, but particularly, you know, low limb injuries were the most frequent problem that we're dealing with, and often a priority as well.
And then what techniques, how are you actually reconstructing? What are the factors in it? Nerve, bone?
So all of that. So, for example, following a transfemoral amputation, so an above knee amputation, that residual limb might have a whole range of problems. So it might have might be a bit short. There might be some heterotopic bone, so bone that's grown where it's not normally needed, and that can cause problems. Nerve related pain from the amputated nerves, scar or skin graft that's unstable, so it's ulcerating or it ulcerates as soon as they try and walk on their leg. The contour can be a problem. So if you've got a big indent, because the sockets are suspended, usually by suction, and that means that you've got to have a really good fit between the liner socket and the stump. So if you haven't got a nice uniform stump shape, then the leg falls off.
And then, you know, when we were saying before, we really briefly went through it just a couple of minutes ago, but the kind of hierarchy of what you need to do. So pain being the first one, is that right?
Yeah.
And then how does it go through?
So the priorities are always you want somebody to be basically healed and for those scars to be durable, whatever they want to do. So being healed, being pain-free, restoring function. So it's and you're usually trying to do all of those things. So you just want to make, for example, if somebody's got a problem stump, you want that to make it as good as it can be, all in one.
To then potentially get a prosthetic on.
Yeah, so for an amputation, it's all about not having pain and being able to wear your prosthesis as long as you want.
How did it progress through? So from 2008, what did you see anything different as time went on? Did you see a difference in the injury, even if it's subtle?
I mean, that's an interesting question, because it's still, I still see somebody, the occasional person that is new to me that hasn't had late reconstruction after injuries in Afghan. So I'm still seeing a trickle of people with those original injuries that are coming to me now late. But more and more what I'm seeing now are people who had a limb that was salvaged but isn't turning out to be good enough because it's painful, for example, and they're looking to have an amputation
because of nerve damage and mobility,
for all of that. So a limb that was salvaged has turned out not to be a good enough limb, and they're looking for to solve that with an amputation.
So what's an example of that? Someone gets shot maybe, or as fragging Afghan?
Yeah, so gunshot and frag injuries, mounted IED injuries, so complex hind foot injuries, which are and I, that they're really difficult to treat because you get the joints at the back of the foot are injured and painful. Mm. So they get pain and stiffness, and they try and offset that with special types of splint. But that, you know, that's the sort of thing that can deteriorate with time.
So, something
that was kind of, over the years. So yeah, something that was kind of okay to begin with is not okay now.
So there's a real delay in the problem.
That's right. And then the other group is I'm seeing people who had okay stumps, which are not okay now. And they're looking for sort of lesser revisions, if you like. And then there are people who just couldn't face surgery, late reconstruction early on, who are now coming around to the idea that maybe they're ready for it now.
And, I mean, it must be pretty bad for someone to have the pain must be pretty bad, or the mobility or whatever, to be pretty bad, to then come to say, I want this limb amputated. That's pretty... What's your process in that then? If someone came up to you or a colleague and said, I want it off.
Yeah.
What is there a process before that happens?
That's interesting because in the end, if the most common reason for an amputation is pain, to relieve pain. So we just have to listen to what somebody's saying about their pain and believe them and believe that it's affecting them in that way. And you have an idea of that because you are familiar with the injuries and you have an idea of how painful that might be. And you can see what medication they're on. You can see how it's affecting the rest of them. That chronic, living with chronic severe pain is exhausting and it has lots of other effects on your mental health. Your ability to perform, you know, sleeping, working, your relationships within the family.
There's a lot of characteristics there that link in with PTSD as well.
That's right, yeah.
Sleep, yeah. That it starts with that sleep.
Yeah. Having chronic pain is exhausting and it affects your ability to cope with other things. Mm. And it's not unusual to combine with other problems.
Do you have to be careful? I don't know if it's your realm. Do you have to be careful with administering painkillers or advising on painkillers? Is addiction a problem with opiates especially?
It is, and if somebody's had long-standing severe pain, then they're often on lots of meds and have been on them for a long time already. So you do have to manage that around surgery. And what we're aiming, and most guys want to get off that because they don't like the side effects. They don't like the fact that they're taking meds. And they want to feel more normal, which means not taking regular meds and having their head clear.
Yeah.
And we can help with that. You know, I'd like everybody to not have pain and not be on any meds.
Yeah.
But it needs a bit of managing. So, because some of the opiates are something that you become physically and psychologically tolerant and dependent. So that needs... So there's a bit of, you need some pain relief to bridge the period of the amputation and getting healed. And then what we're aiming to do is wean those meds. And to be honest, particularly nerve pain, if you're living with that, then even some reduction in your pain is worth the bother. Even if it's not relieving all of your pain, it's worth the trouble. Reducing, even if you don't come off all of your meds, that's worthwhile.
Just as we're speaking, we see people in Invictus, we see people in the Paralympics, and we look at them and be like, oh, they're doing, look how great they're doing.
Yeah.
But we're just, as we're speaking now, when I'm kind of piecing the jigsaw together, there's a lot of SHIT that's been done to get to that point, and maybe in the future as well. I'm not so sure on that, but to get to that point where you're rowing or weightlifting, whatever,
So I know a lot of the guys that have competed in the Invictus Games, and I'm very proud of what they do, because I know where I have an idea of what they've been through to get that to that point, and I know that they're not necessarily, you know, they will be having to cope with some degree of pain or other mischief around their injuries, that they're just toughing it. They're just toughing it out for the sake of for training and competing. It's not, I think it's easy to look at what they're doing and think that being an amputee is the solution. But it's not easy being an amputee.
Yeah.
Physically.
Yeah, and it can be, especially on social media, we can, I mean, I'm not going to delve too into this, but we can see people being very strong and capable and able, and it's almost this kind of echo of strength that's been put out there.
Yeah.
But actually, like you said, there's a lot of factors, and Si is a perfect example of that. He has down days. He has times when he feels vulnerable. He also has huge amounts of strength and growth that has come off the back of it as well. What kind of, even just if we talk about the physical aspects of a consequence of an amputation, what are we looking at post-surgery and kind of into recovery?
So having an amputation means that you have to expend more energy to do normal things. So to walk at a certain speed, you have to expend more energy to do that than you did before you had the amputation. So you work harder to do everything. You sweat, you feel hot, you know, you have problems with the skin inside your socket. There'll be niggles with skin that you have to deal with, areas that are painful. So it's not trouble-free. We're not, as humans, designed to be amputees. So there's always admin involved in being an amputee.
Day-to-day.
So yeah, just on an everyday, in an everyday way. And all the, you know, your prosthetic, you're constantly replacing bits of it, or your body, especially when you're training, your stump shape will change. You're sort of constantly making allowances for that.
Mm.
So there's, you know, you're chasing the prosthetic center for your replacement liner, or the knee mechanism needs fixing, or, you know, there's lots of admin involved.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, even when I've been with Si, or I've met him at Waterloo, whatever, or when he came into the podcast, the prime example, there was just a big planning stage before that. It's not just as simple as hop on a train, nip into London, hop back. There's a lot of planning involved. And we mentioned it in one of the podcasts, actually, the summary podcast. He split up a fight outside in Leicester Square, and his leg came off, and he was in the waiting room outside sorting his leg out and refitting it all and whatnot after the recording. And we can often forget that when we see it on, like I say, social media or Invictus, and obviously sport's been a huge part of, and Invictus has been a huge part of that recovery, but so is surgery as well. And if we just kind of talk an overview and get professional on it, talk about you as an individual professional. Was the war in Afghanistan a good thing for you, Alex, the plastic surgeon?
I'd have to say yes to that. And that's because plastic surgery, modern plastic surgery, arose in the First and Second World Wars around the experience of treating injured servicemen from gunshot injuries to the face, the burns of the fighter pilots. That was the birth of modern plastic surgery. And we've learnt even more with our injured from Afghanistan. And I finished my training just at the right moment to be involved, and I was I feel very fortunate to become, to have been involved early on in my career, because they're such a special cohort of patients from a surgical point of view, because of the combination of, as we've said before, the combination of the injuries in that particular group of individuals. And so from a selfish, from a technical selfish point of view, it's fascinating and challenging, but I have a very strong instinctive desire to fix them because of what they've sacrificed. So that for me is the perfect storm. You know, they're young and fit, they've got these amazingly complex injuries, and I want to look after them because of what they've done.
I mean, you're proud of that, proud of your patients. I suppose some of them have become friends as well, I should imagine.
They have.
You get close. I know you, your care is, and I know this from people who I know, that you've looked after, your level of care is beyond what's expected. I know you weren't like that. Rolling her eyes for the, but it is, and I think because this group of people, it's so unusual to have that amount of people in one area that are allowing you to do things that, like you've already said, normally wouldn't have been possible. What are we seeing off the back of that then? How is medical science, plastic surgery, medical science, how has it developed? Let's talk about plastic surgery. How has that developed? How has it grown? You know, we talk about post-traumatic growth a lot on this podcast. How have we grown because of the trauma? But how have we grown because of conflict? How has your profession grown? And can you give me some kind of specifics?
Going back slightly, one of the things that has already been extrapolated from our experience at Camp Bastion is the immediate management of that sort of trauma. Because it was that experience that triggered the advent of the major trauma centres. So understanding that you improved outcomes if you had a team that was dedicated and concentrated to look after these sorts of patients. So the concentration of expertise for the more severe trauma in the major trauma centres was a consequence of our experience in Bastion, and that includes the immediate control of hemorrhage, how we use blood products, imaging, and damage limitation surgery has been revisited. I mean, that's something that we should have learned from all our previous conflicts over the centuries, but it's been relearned, if you like. And that has been directly extrapolated to the NHS. I think the other things that we're going to learn from these cohort of patients will take longer to come to fruition. That's what I've learned in the late reconstruction of these guys. I have extrapolated to how I manage civilian trauma via the major trauma centres. And I think rehabilitation will be the final thing that we really learn again, that we improve on.
So the next 30 years, next 40 years, of getting into it and really figuring out different growth, or
seeing how well people did with the approach to rehabilitation at Headley Court. So Headley Court was special because unlike anywhere else in the NHS, you had inpatient admission for intense episodes of rehabilitation, class. People were together with their mates again, and they were training together, and that's really important, particularly for military patients, I think. And then what they learned about the prosthetic rehabilitation in particular, with amputations that weren't very straightforward, but that experience at Headley Court hasn't quite been extrapolated to the NHS, partly because it's expensive, but you know, there are lessons to be learned there. So some things have been taken on board.
Like what?
So in terms of the immediate management, major trauma centres,
So
that the whole journey, if you look at the whole sort of pathway for somebody who's blown up in Afghanistan and where they end up when they're they've completed their rehab. If you look at all aspects of that pathway, we're still, we haven't translated all of that yet to the NHS.
And then just going in, we went back there. Now just going into to you, what have you learned? What have you been able to test? And you know, has there been anything where it's never been tried before? You and your teams.
Specifically from a plastic surgery point of view, the things that made these injuries difficult were the nature of the injury. So blast produces a very diffuse injury, even in the bits of you that are left behind to reconstruct. And that includes the blood vessels, and that makes my life difficult when it comes to microsurgery. So if I'm transferring tissue, disconnecting its blood supply, and then wanting to reconnect it to an artery and vein in wherever the defect is, then my life is more difficult because of the nature of the injury. So it's more testing surgically. Traditionally, you aim to move out of the zone of injury when you're looking at the recipient site. So if when you're trying to work out what artery and vein you're going to use to join to connect to, in an ideal world you move outside of the zone of injury, but you can't do that in these injuries because the zone of injury is so extensive.
It's so big, so you can't go back an inch. Is that what you mean?
Yeah,
like you can't go
exactly.
Back an inch,
yeah. So if you take an above knee amputation stump, for example, and I think I may have shown you a couple of photographs. So it's quite a short residual limb. And you've got the level of the blast injury, and then you've maybe got some further injury further up from the tourniquet that was used, and then a bit higher up in the groin or in the lower abdomen, you've got more injury from surgery to control the bleeding. So you can't escape. You can't move to a place that hasn't been injured already. So from my point of view, that's much higher risk. We're much more likely to need vein grafts, so using a bit of vein from somewhere else as an extension cable. And because of everything that's happened to that person, they're running out of veins that we can nick from somewhere else for that job.
So it's so blasé, and these images that you show me are just remarkable, especially the stuff with the way you're connecting the nerve and the calf where there was one where it was two calves with advein a nerve damage, and you what was that one?
So he had on one side he had the skin and some muscle missing off the back of the leg that was exposing a nerve. So he had the nerve wasn't working, it was painful, and he had some ulceration. And on the other side, he had a really damaged foot. So we moved some of the muscle and skin from the one side to resurface the other side, rearranging the deck chairs. But it gave him, instead of having two bad legs, he had a better leg and quite a good below knee. Stump.
I mean, it looked remarkable. The difference. It was just absolutely remarkable. Do you, when you're in surgery, and let's say a lower leg has to come off,
yeah,
because of piecing it together and making it less pain and all the rest of it. Do you do the amputation?
I do. Yeah.
Ah, okay. So you, I thought someone else had come in.
No.
So you'll do the amputation.
I'll do the amputation.
What's the reason behind that? Is it just consistency? Is that just the way it's done?
Amputations are a funny thing because they're done by... In the past, I think they were slightly looked down on as a procedure, sort of underestimated. And they were done by all sorts of people. So they were done by orthopaedic surgeons, vascular surgeons, still are, and plastic surgeons. But you need to do... Amputations need to be done very carefully if you want the best possible stump, which will be the highest functioning stump. But But I do, yeah, I do those.
Mm. What do you... might not be appropriate. I mean, what do you actually use to get through the
A very
bone?
Large saw.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Hand saw?
Yeah,
electric.
Hand saw, yeah. Battery. So it's a sagittal saw. So
yeah.
The blade, you're using the end of the... rather than a reciprocating, which is like a bread knife.
Yeah, yeah.
Styly. This will be oscillating, and the cutting end of the saw is at the end.
Yeah. So it, fine moving.
Yeah.
Just not those big movements.
Yeah.
Is equipment changed over the last kind of 10 years?
Or
is it still drawn the same stuff?
No, that hasn't changed very much. It's more what you do and how you do it rather than what you're using.
Mm.
The microscope was introduced in, actually that's one of the things I'm particularly proud of, and I didn't realise until I was appointed as a consultant, but my grandfather, I understand, was the first to introduce an operating microscope to the UK. He was an eye surgeon, which is quite cool, I think. But I use that's my everyday.
Is it?
Using a microscope, yeah. I'm either using a microscope wearing funny looking glasses with loops.
What kind of, how does the microphone? No point even saying this because no one's watching it. But I was just about to ask. It's a bit ridiculous then. But how is a microscope used? Is it brought?
So it's on an arm, a bit like these microphones, and you position it over the patient.
Yeah. Okay. And what magnification is it?
So that usually goes up to times 40.
So that's microsurgery when you're dealing with that.
So the term microsurgery was coined by somebody who worked out how to repair an artery that measured 1.4 millimetres in internal diameter. That was a while ago now, in the early 60s.
And what are you using? Do you use your hands with equipment?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. So you're using a microscope to give you magnification. You're using very specific instruments that are designed for that, for microsurgery, and you're using specific techniques. So you need all of those things to be able to make it work. It's hand sewn.
Yeah.
So for an artery that's maybe 1 to 2 millimeters in diameter, you're putting maybe 8 stitches in that.
Physical stitching it up, not glue.
Stitching, yeah. Yeah, with a needle and thread, so to speak.
And how long would something like that take?
So that takes maybe 40 minutes to repair an artery and a vein under the microscope.
1.4
Yeah.
Millimetres.
Thereabouts,
takes
yeah.
40 minutes.
So that's the flap-off time. So once you've disconnected some tissue from its blood supply to the time when you have the blood supply, the blood flow restored, when you take the little clamps off the blood vessels, you measure that time, and it's usually around 40 minutes.
And then they still all do the work to do around that as
Yes, that's right. So that's one of the steps. So you've got an operation is a sequence of steps. So, for example, that stump revision, the first, and this is one of the things I've learned with these patients, is that it's safer to stage the procedure, by which I mean we might do first bit of the operation one day and the rest of it on another day. So on the first day, we'd do the unravelling bit, where we take all the scar off, lift the skin, unravel the muscle, find the nerves, find the blood vessels, sort out the bone, temporary dressing on that, and then the next day we do the reconstructive part of the procedure. And that will mean raising the flap, which will take a couple of hours, doing the microsurgery, which will take, you know, a little under an hour, and then you've got the insetting of the flap and closing of the donor site, so where we've taken the flap from. And there may be other stages. We sometimes delay completing the closure of some of the wounds for another day.
And when we're doing multiple days like that, does the patient come back?
Yeah, and awake, asleep, awake, asleep.
Are they a bit out of it?
A bit.
Yeah.
So particularly after a long, so that the second stage involving the microsurgery, that might take all day.
Mm.
So they're a bit sleepy after that.
but potentially the legs open as well.
Yeah, with the dressing on, it's not, oh, yeah, you know, okay, it's okay. Not, it's not gory.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a lot to put somebody through. It's a huge responsibility. You they're taking a risk by trusting you, and I'm taking the risk on their behalf. I feel that's, you know, it's a big responsibility, and you know that it's going to make a big difference to them, and you also know that they might not have another opportunity. If this flap doesn't work, if that transfer of that tissue doesn't work, they may not have another one that they can use for that purpose. So it has to work.
So you
have to commit yourself to making it work. And sometimes it's been difficult to get it to work. Mm. But you have to fight.
Is it consistent? Is plastic surgery, especially with this trauma, is it consistent? As in, can you predict?
Is it reliable?
Reliable, yeah.
It's pretty reliable. So the flap failure rate is low. Generally, people, sort of 3% flap loss rate would be considered acceptable.
Mm.
It ought to be higher in these patients. We've been lucky so far. We haven't lost any.
Lucky. Technical. Lucky.
It's been close occasionally, but yeah.
Yeah. The and just when you were talking about there, that the multiple operations over several days, this is with the NHS?
Yeah.
And because we hear about doctors getting hammered and lack of sleep, after the... Are you dealing with... Let's say you deal with Psy.
Yeah.
Is that you done? If you do a four-hour operation, are you then going to do another four-hour operation?
Might do, yeah.
Yeah.
So it depends. You have lists that are allocated to you that you have, that are available to you, and you fill them.
How do you concentrate for that period of time? Because like air traffic control,
is
20 minutes and they're off.
Yeah.
How are you concentrating when it's so important? You're saying that responsibility is so high, their long-term wellness, not to put the pressure on here, but the rest of their life, they might be 21-year-old lads. How are you focusing for 4 hours plus to 14 hours at a time?
Well, we help mitigate that problem by sharing those cases because we know that they are particularly difficult. So we do a fair amount of microsurgery outside of this cohort of patients, and these are more at the more difficult end of the spectrum. And for that reason, for all the microsurgical cases in these patients, we've undertaken those as with two of us. So you can do some of the operating you can do simultaneously. So I could be raising the flap while Rod is preparing the recipient vessels. So you can save time by working at the same time.
Mm.
The other advantage is that although you plan as much as you can beforehand, there are always decisions to be made at the time of surgery, depending on what you find or what happens. And it helps, it's more secure if you've got somebody else, a like-minded person that you're working with. And as you say, because it's they can be long operations, it just gives you that, it gives you that a bit of extra. You can go for further and longer if there are two of you.
Mm.
But, you know, in an ideal world, like air traffic controllers, you'd have a break every 20 or 40 minutes, but you can't always do that in medicine, particularly in surgery. You can't.
Well, I suppose it's like the lads as well. I mean, they haven't had 20 minute breaks when they've been in a firefight or
exactly.
Going through a stress.
It is, exactly. You can't, you know, life isn't ideal in those jobs.
Mm.
So you just have to, you have to be able to cope with that.
Was it wrong when you was talking about then, when you was talking about the old operation, the operations in multiple days, where I was picturing a car, like the wheels come off, the engine comes out, you deal with the engine, all the finer points of it, and then you start putting it all back together.
Yeah, there's an undoing and there's a doing up again phase. Yeah.
To make it, it fascinates me. I just can't get that, especially seeing them pictures. It's just the intricacy of it, the detail, and you're seeing things I can't see. I'm just seeing redness. and the occasional thing popping out, and you're seeing those micro.
No, it's beautiful detail. Under the microscope. It's a beautiful world under the microscope.
Really? I mean, it's incredible. Where are we going in the future? Because things are closing down. Is money an issue? Is facilities an issue? You know, that transition between a guy leaving the MOD and then being placed into NHS care. There's not 10,000 of you. What's the future? I kind of give you a lot to think about there, but
money is always an issue. I'm sure that I've lost a great deal of money for my hospital already, because there are tariffs that the hospital can invoice for these cases, but they're inadequate. They don't pay for the actual cost. So I've probably run up a huge debt on behalf of my hospital.
Good.
Which I'm not sure if I care too much about that, because I'm still able to do what's needed. Mm-hmm. I'm now seeing lots of people who have transitioned or are transitioning. So usually people will delay their medical discharge to complete their prosthetic rehab through Headley Court, now Stanford Hall. But once that's happened, then they're out. And they then, from a prosthetic point of view, are relying on the prosthetic centres in the NHS. You may have heard of the Murison report and the fact that a subset of our NHS prosthetic centres became Murison centres, so they had some additional funding to support our veterans.
So centre, I think, is the 11?
Yeah, that's right.
Centers.
So I've got Portsmouth and Bournemouth near me, and Portsmouth is a Murison centre.
But NHS?
NHS still.
But priority veteran? Or
not exactly priority, but additional funding available.
Okay.
For prosthetics.
Yeah.
There's very little in the way of rehab in the NHS, which is a deal. But from a prosthetics point of view, what I understand now is that when they acquire a veteran, they have to apply for the money to continue whatever prosthetic provision they have currently. So it's it's additional admin, and from the prosthetics point of view, and although it should have been an opportunity to enhance the expertise in that prosthetic centre, I'm not sure if it's always has always been viewed in that way. Because these are high demand patients who are used to having low turnaround times.
Like I've said before, you know, I spoke to just before we came in here, I spoke to Si, and one of his major concerns is that prosthetic provision.
Yeah.
And the maintenance of that prescription.
Yes.
He has a real, I don't know, he's speaking for a lot of people, there's a major concern with that, where turnaround time for a piece of equipment, for example, or a piece of the prosthetic would be 2 weeks, now it's 6 months.
Yeah. So frustrating, because it puts the rest of their life on hold. There is a mechanism, if you're not, if you're struggling with your whatever the prosthetics centre is providing, or you're struggling with getting a socket to fit you comfortably and that will work, then they can apply through the Veterans Prosthetic Panel for you to return to Stanford Hall to be reassessed as a veteran, because they've been very strict about not allowing veterans to return to Headley Court or Stanford Hall. So once you're medically discharged, you don't have access to that.
So once you're out, you're in the NHS.
Once you're out, yeah, it's sort of binary.
And Blesma, because they're doing a lot.
So Blesma
are linking in with that.
Yeah, no, Blesma are a wonderful charity, and they're really, really good advocates for our veterans in terms of chasing the prosthetic centres for what they need, and potentially to encourage that referral. And the other thing that's happening a bit more now is that there's approval being given for prosthetics privately as well, with private companies.
Paid for?
Yeah.
What, because of Blesma or because of just the situation? What?
After referral and after application to the via the VPP.
And how do people get onto that? What do they actually have to do to get?
So the unfortunately, I can't do it. Blesma, they can help you, but it has to come from the prosthetic centre.
Mm. So just for anyone who's listening who doesn't know who Blesma are, they basically represent, advocate, are very relevant to the limbless veterans.
Mm.
And they do a lot of great work. And like we'll say Si again, but he cannot speak more highly enough of their work.
So the military charities are brilliant at filling in the gaps that the NHS doesn't fill. And we've had somebody from Blesma and H4H in our War Injury Clinics in the recent past, which is brilliant, because when we see somebody, particularly for the first time, it means that other than discussing their what we might do for them surgically, they can help between them. They can help out with transport costs, accommodation around visiting us and coming for surgery, including their families or partner, advocacy around pensions and Armed Forces Compensation Scheme, prosthetic centres. So they can fill in some of the gaps as well, like a sort of MOT.
One thing that's shining through is your passion for it and your dedication for this. And I know Rod's the same as well. But Si Hammer did say that you're the brains behind the...
he knows which side his bread's going to be.
But why do you care so much? We briefly talked about that, but why do you care so much? Why do you go way over and above? Why are you doing this? Why have you taken the day off to come over here for a one-hour podcast with me? Why do you care so much?
I'm not really sure. It's a sort of instinct. It's instinctive. It's I think it's because of what you do and what you have done and how you have borne those injuries. I'm very impressed. I'm grateful.
I'll skip a few things and the Simon, he said that he wanted to say thank you to you because life would be nowhere near as good if it weren't for you and Rod dealing with his injury and his with his children, with the way he works and functions now.
Mm.
I speak to people like Mickey Yule and various others, and because you do need to be recognised as well, because you do go, your level of care with everyone I've spoke to goes way above and beyond, whether it's coming down to dress the wounds where a nurse should be doing or 99% of the time is doing, and you want to come down and dress the wounds of these guys.
Mm.
And you do need recognition for that. You are the most under the radar person on Google that you could imagine, but you have such a big impact on a lot of people's lives, their families, and then their future rehabilitation and long-term recovery. And from Simon, on behalf of everyone else, I just want to say thank you very much for everything you're doing and what you do, and for the future generations of people that are going to benefit because of all your work. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It is a privilege.
We will leave it there.